Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am your host, Neil Pollack, the greatest living American writer and the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We cover the worlds of books and film and streaming TV and so much more. We have an excellent and provocative program for you this week. Stephen Garrett will be along in a little bit to talk with me about two new lesbian-themed crime movies, lesbian noirs. One is a comedy, one is not a comedy. We're talking about Love Lies Bleeding and Drive Away Dolls. Both of them are in theaters now or on their way out of theaters now, as it may be. But first, we're going to talk to Sharon Vane and Michael Washburn, two of our best contributors, about a very serious issue ongoing in the literary and creative communities, and that's sort of an antipathy towards Jewish people and of Israel, and specifically Israel, but also Jews in general. There's definitely a wave of anti-Semitism among literary types, and it concerns me, and it concerns us at Book and Film Globe. And Sharon and Michael have written about this topic and will be here right after this musical interlude to talk to me about it. There's been a disturbing trend among literary people, artistic people in general, but particularly among the literary community, regarding the Israel-Hamas conflict. They are proving extremely intolerant of any view or opinion or expression that might be deemed pro-Israeli. And while I understand that the Israel-Palestine conflict is complicated, to say the least, and that there's plenty of room for criticizing the Israeli government and other aspects of the situation, I am disturbed by the sort of uniformity of opinion regarding Israel and Jewish people in particular. And we have published a couple of articles in the last week about this topic. Sharon Vane wrote something for us, and Michael Washburn wrote something for us, and they're both here with me today to talk about this. Hello, guys.
Hello.
Hi, Neil.
Hello. So yes, thanks for adding to this conversation. Sharon, I wanted to start with you. You wrote about the actor Brett Gelman, who we know is kind of the wacky scientist from Stranger Things. He's done a bunch of other comedic work. He published a debut collection of short stories, which has absolutely nothing to do with the Israel-Palestine conflict. There's sort of neurotic stories about Jewish identity, or not even Jewish identity, as far as I can tell. But he's also been very outspoken in support of Israel and demanding that Hamas release its hostages on social media and in media appearances. And he's having a lot of trouble getting bookstore gigs, which is shocking to me, honestly.
Well, I think, you know, you put it well. I mean, the book doesn't have anything to do with the Israel-Hamas conflict. And certainly in his private life, as we all do, he has been a very outspoken and ardent advocate for, you know, the Israeli people and Jewish people here in America who, you know, might have relatives in Israel. And as a result, there have been security threats at bookstores. The book actually comes out today, the day that we're recording this, and four bookstores have
March 19th, for those of you who are listening. Yes.
Yeah.
And bookstores are
four bookstores have canceled scheduled appearances. And, you know, they're saying it's because of security threats that they've gotten at the stores. But Gelman has been pretty outspoken to say, I find it a little surprising, even after I offered to provide additional private security to kind of assuage those concerns, that they're still not comfortable going forward with it. And he has very publicly wondered if some, I would say deep-seated, but it's pretty overt, anti-Semitism is playing a role in him having these tour stops silenced.
Well, you know, and they cite security concerns, but there was this one San Francisco bookstore who talked about how they didn't like the way that Gelman was talking about certain ethnic groups. And, you know, I don't think Brett Gelman is a racist. You know, I'm just guessing. Maybe he is. I mean, I don't know him personally. He could be a secret racist. But I think they just didn't like the way he was talking about Hamas, which is not an ethnic group. It's a political party.
Well, true. And I mean, they, you know, the owner of Book Passage in San Francisco said, we canceled because Gelman made what he termed as intemperate and ill-advised remarks that he made against some other ethnic and social groups, but didn't detail who those groups were, wouldn't explain any more. And look, this is a thorny situation. There's a lot of conversation to be had on all sides. But when we're canceling bookstores, let's just say it's because of these threats. I mean, when we're threatening bookstores because a Jewish writer who wrote a book of Jewish short stories is appearing, and separately, he's talked about, supporting the Israeli people. I mean, it's just a slippery slope. It's not even a slippery slope. We're like down the slippery slope.
Oh, we're way down it. We're at the bottom of it. You're basically saying you can't read at our store because you're Jewish. I mean, and it's extremely disturbing. So, Michael, I wanted to bring you in here, and then I'm going to try to tie all this stuff together. You wrote about an international situation. The South African writer Zukiswa Wanner. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yes.
Zukiswa Wanner, she's a South African, mostly, like, as far as I can tell, she writes travel books and children's books, but she won the prestigious Goethe Medal from the government of Germany. I mean, that's a prestigious literary award. That's a top 10 literary award. And she returned it this year because Germany refuses to condemn Israel. I mean, the ironies of a South African writer returning a literary medal, which is given to people who try to promote peace and tolerance, about Germany supporting Israel is the irony is mind-boggling.
People for many years talked about the white minority government in South Africa as if it was practically an extension of Nazi Germany, and their whole critique of the racist society drew upon World War II and fascism. And now the South African writer objects to Germany supporting the Jewish state. So you're right, the irony is supreme, and it's really not a pleasant thing to contemplate. And I just couldn't help noting in my piece how arbitrary I found her decision to be and how little rationale she put forward for it. And if you are going to think this way, how far are you going to take it? Should people never have accepted the Nobel Prize because the government of Sweden was insufficiently anti-Nazi?
Or because Alfred Nobel invented dynamite.
And so when you said earlier that this is an international issue, I think you really hit the nail on the head. And you know what happened subsequent to Zukiswa Wanner returning her prize or announcing she would return it? A group of authors came out and said that they are pulling out of the Penn World Voices Festival because they find Penn America insufficiently anti-Israel. And they think that Penn America has been leaning too far in favor of Israel and not seeing things from Hamas's point of view. So they sent this open letter that a lot of people have signed announcing that they're pulling out. And these are some prominent writers, Naomi Klein, Michelle Alexander, Lori Moore. These are some big names in the world of letters. And, anti-Semitism on the left is really a terrible problem. And there's this related issue of uniformity of thought and unwillingness to look at this situation fairly and objectively and to fall in line with this anti-Israel orthodoxy and this whole Marxist influence worldview that views everything in terms of oppressors and oppressed, no matter how complex the actual situation.
Well, and Sharon wrote about this too. I mean, here's what I think is interesting about this particular conversation. You know, Michael, you lean on to the conservative end of the political spectrum, and Sharon, I know you well. I consider you sort of a left progressive for the most part. And, my politics are just that I'm right about everything. I'll put myself in the middle. But we all have this, concern here. And it's pretty uniform that the basis of all of this is anti-Semitism. You wrote about this in your piece, Sharon, about, and this has been widely covered in other publications, the literary magazine Guernica, which I believe is a British magazine, which admittedly I haven't looked at since I was in college, but, they published a lovely piece by an Israeli writer talking about the difficulty of this time in Israel. And it was very measured and very beautifully written. And the entire staff quit. And many contributors just bailed.
Yeah, this was not, you know, some kind of, you know, Israel or bust or I love Netanyahu kind of piece. It was this very, I thought, thoughtful piece. You know, this writer, you know, volunteered driving, you know, Gazan families to Israeli hospitals so they could get treatment both before and after October 7th. You know, she talked about, you know, trying to connect with her friends in Gaza and just, you know, kind of lamenting this terrible state of the war. It was not, you know, a diatribe or a polemic in any way, shape or form. Yet the response, there was no room in that magazine from, you know, this worldview of we're going to share any perspective that might humanize the Israelis or indicate any sort of spectrum of response. You know, there's no room for anything other than you are 100% against the state of Israel and you 100%, you know, hashtag pro-Palestine. And, you know, I mentioned in my piece, I mean, there are lists going around on X of, well, we boycott these writers because they're Zionist. And in many cases, these are people who said, I think both Israel should exist and Palestine should exist, and I'm against deaths of civilians.
That's you know, like saying all lives matter. That is the most anodyne political statement you could possibly make about the conflict.
Yeah, and there's people want to boycott, and there's you know, as Michael pointed out, that it's kind of this groupthink of there is one right opinion. And we do not have a free exchange of ideas. We can't see the other side's humanity. We're not even going to entertain the publication of an essay. We can't even read it. It has to be out.
Can't even read it. Can't even think of, you can't even possibly think that Jews are human. It's just bizarre to me. I mean, Michael, you mentioned the sort of Marxist worldview, which I think is one way of looking at it. And I thought that maybe a lot of this is that, you know, American writers, most of them, the people who are literary, quote unquote, have been educated in the academy in the last 20 years. And the academy, as we've seen, is in the last few months, is fervently anti-Israel and borderline anti-Semitic. And I think globally, the situation, we've seen also globally that Jews are not welcome in Europe like they have been in our lifetimes. But I just don't understand. I don't understand. These are writers. You know, writers, you know, were so integral in letting us know about the dangers of anti-Semitism during and after World War II. And I as a writer myself, I am very angry and frustrated with my cohort, and I don't even really consider them my cohort anymore, about their attitudes towards Israel and Jews.
Well, anti-Semitism on the left has been an issue for many, many years. People don't want to talk about it. And what some leftists do who despise Israel is they use this sort of more polite term, anti-Zionist, and they mask their hatred under that label. But look, a lot of them are obviously anti-Semitic and committed to this groupthink, and they hold this attitude that they have to agree with every single thing that a publication prints or they're going to resign and boycott the publication. And this anti-Semitism on the left, to stay on the issue here, this is really a very, very serious issue, and it has been for years, and it has burst out more into the open, but it's not a new phenomenon. And I'd like to ask both of you, because I think you both have many liberal, left-wing, and progressive friends.
And we're both Jewish.
Who would be very quick to decry white supremacy. How many of them have said to you or confided to you, you know, I'm really very troubled by the anti-Semitism that I see on the left. It's really bothering me a lot, and something needs
quite a few. And, you know, I can, you know, share, I consider Sharon a good friend of mine. I would say that in some ways, Sharon, this has been kind of a red pill situation for you, at least on some issues, because it's been shocking to me how many people who I thought I knew and trusted don't really like the Jews that much.
Well, it's in the same way. There's that public discourse. There's also the private discourse where there's also no room for anything other than groupthink. And to Michael's point, many folks that I've worked with who are not Jewish, but have worked with on progressive causes, and we have, you know, fought the good fight, now occupy a very different space and don't necessarily want to hear any nuance. They want, you know, people want to have this overly simplified view of an incredibly complex situation. If it was easy, we would have fixed it by now, right? There's lots of things to talk about. And, you know, it's not shocking to me. It is saddening to me how there are so many on the left are unable to hold, you know, there's that phrase holding multiple truths at once that gets trotted out a lot, but not for the Jews. Nobody can hold the idea that there's, you know, strife on both sides. There's problems on both sides. There are high points on both sides. There are good people on both sides.
And not to mention that Israelis and Jews suffered a severe trauma on October 7th that will be with us for the rest of our lives and will affect us and our families forever. And there's I don't hear a lot of sympathy.
Like, not only not a lot of sympathy, we don't hear anything about those hostages except for the best you get is a phrase, hostages on October 7th. Like, unless you're talking with Jewish people or Israeli people, they're like, I mean, no one talks about those hostages at all. If it was a different group of hostages being held, there would be hashtags for them. Yeah, there would be yellow ribbons for them. Yeah. Everybody would be saying, bring them home. And now we see it's just Jewish people.
Well, okay, so we're not going to solve this problem, the three of us right here. So let's cycle it back, because what Book and Film Globe does is we cover, you know, issues in the artistic community, right? And I would say, you know, this is also an issue, to say the least, among film creatives. I mean, anyone who listened to Jonathan Glazer's really awful acceptance speech during the Oscars, I don't even want to talk about that. It made me so angry to listen to that and watching the room full of people with their pro-Palestine lapel pins just applaud his self-hatred. But, you know, that's the same attitude kind of prevails in the literary community. And so what you're having is writers who are being basically sort of, I wouldn't say blacklisted, but, you know, shut down because they hold the wrong opinions. And, you know, Sharon, you did point out there has been some censorship of pro-Palestinian voices as well. You know, there was a writer who had an event canceled at the 92nd Street Y because he refused to condemn Hamas appropriately. And I don't think that's right either. I don't think that's the prevailing problem. There is a groupthink among literary people. And I wish I understood why.
Well, we talked about Marx earlier. This also goes back to Herbert Marcuse. You were talking about academia and how some of the people who are coming out and behaving this way were schooled in the last couple of decades at universities where a certain orthodoxy prevails. And this is very much the legacy of Marcuse, who wrote this essay in 1968, Repressive Tolerance, and he called for withdrawal of freedom of expression and assembly for those advocating militarism, racism, and opposing the extension of social services. So Marcuse, he came out and said in this essay, Repressive Tolerance, that people he called reactionaries, they should not be allowed to speak because it does not serve the interests of progressives for them to be able to express their view freely. And so that was how Marcuse saw the issue. And that's obviously how a lot of people today see it. Whether in publishing or in journalism or in academia or the media, we see this constantly. And it's important, Neil, that you raised the issue of what happened on October 7th. And the fact that people on the left are now accusing Israel of genocide, because they are taking the regrettable collateral damage that has happened in this conflict, and they're using that as a pretext to try to compare the current government of Israel to the Third Reich. I think that's ludicrous.
It is. Well, and I feel like writers are doing the same thing. And I don't know. Maybe I just have too high of an opinion of myself as a writer, but I just feel like writers should know better. And What I'm going to keep doing, and I pledge to keep doing on Book and Film Globe as long as I can, and I know you all will help me out, is that if these kinds of issues pop up, and they're going to, over and over again, we're going to keep covering it, and we're going to, you know, do our little part to hold the literary community's feet to the fire, because I you know what, I just don't have any time for this kind of nonsense. You know, writers need to, they can express any opinion that they want, but, you know, they need to be on the right side of history here, and the right side of history is never being anti-Semitic, as far as I'm concerned.
Hear, hear.
Hear, hear. Thus saith the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, Michael Washburn. Sharon Vain, thank you so much for covering these issues for us and for talking to me today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Neil.
One of the oddest genre coincidences in a long time in the movies has been the release of two road movie lesploitation crime dramas. Well, one's actually a comedy, but they're these two lesbian crime movies basically that had come out early this year. One of them is Drive Away Dolls, which is directed by Ethan Coen, one of the Coen brothers, and he also co-wrote the movie. And more recently, saw the release of Love Lies Bleeding from director and writer Rose Glass, who kind of came to public attention with a 2019 psychological horror movie called Saint Maud. And so because of that, so we have these two lesbian crime movies. So I thought it would be naturally important for two heterosexual men to discuss these movies in a completely non-horny way.
Exactly. And explain what the girls got wrong, basically.
Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think this is going to be the most mansplaining segment in the history of podcasting. And Stephen Garrett is here with me today to talk about Drive Away Dolls and Love Lies Bleeding, not from personal experience, but just from an expert in the cinema. So, hello, Stephen.
Hello. Can I start the conversation by asking you, what do you think? I don't think either of these movies are really successful.
No.
Great.
No, well, they're not literally not successful. They're both huge box office busts.
Oh, are they? Well, it makes me think of Bound, which I thought was amazing. I thought it was a great story.
Yeah, it's one of the, that's a great, that's like a classic noir.
Bound, lesbian noir.
Starring Gina Gershon and Jennifer Tilly. And then that guy who was later Ralphie Cifaretto on The Sopranos,
Joey Pants,
and Joey Pants. So yeah, that's a great movie. I don't think
Well, I bring it up only because that was a lesbian noir that was set in the present day and was very of its moment and timeless at the same time. Both of these movies are dated. And like literally dated and also a bit regressive.
They're set in the 80s. They're set in the 80s. Well, both
one's
of them, 80, right?
No, the other's 99, I think. The other, the Coen one is.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. Drive Away Dolls, which I saw a few weeks ago, is set in 1999 because there's a thing about women being able to get married in Massachusetts. So, all right.
Which I think is very telling that they have to set these things in the past in order to have some sort of conflict, societal conflict or judgment that is bearing down on their stories.
Perhaps. But I don't think either of these movies are very unsuccessful. On the other hand, let's talk about Love.
No, that's true.
They're both very watchable and entertaining in their own ways. So let's talk about Love Lies Bleeding first. This is, you know, not a comedy. I would say there's some irony in it. It's not like I didn't enjoy myself watching it. There's lots of gory violence and sexy sex. And I felt like this movie had a kind of a classic noir structure. Kristen Stewart plays a worker at a low rent New Mexico muscle gym, and this very jacked up, oiled up drifter, played by Katie O'Brien, blows into town and starts pumping iron and pumping Kristen Stewart. And and then Kristen Stewart has this dad, played by Ed Harris, who looks exactly like the Crypt Keeper, and and he's like a gun, he's like a sleazy gun runner, evil, you know, weirdo David Lynch like character basically, and you know, troubles ensue, to say the least, and they get ensnared and stuff, and I don't know, I mean, I like the classic noir structure, and as you pointed out in your review, there's Rose Glass does throw a few little avant-garde touches in that distinguish this from, you know, something like, let's say, The Last Seduction or the sort of classic 90s noir revival movies. It's a little arty.
It's a little arty, and I think it's a little impressed with its artiness and thinks it's very outré, and it's very proud of how, like, edgy it is. And I don't think there's much edge to any of it. Like, I feel like it's all been done before, and they're adding this kind of veneer and this gloss of sincere queer representation along with some pretty pat plotting that is juiced, as you might say, steroidally.
By steroids,
with these,
yeah.
Weird avant-garde moments and, like, monochromatic, red wash, dream sequences or whatever the hell it is. I don't know. I was not impressed by itself.
Yeah. Although I did like, it has a nice kind of some ironic ending, very last shot that I really appreciated quite a bit as an aficionado of movie endings. You know, it's not a disaster. Katie O'Brien, it definitely, Kristen Stewart is her usual glum,
Right.
Mumbly self.
As great an actor as she is, I think she's a really great actor. I just don't think there's much for her to do. Katie O'Brien, I thought, was fantastic, and this is her first role.
She fills the screen. She fills the screen with muscular. She's magnetic, and well, she's muscular. that's the whole point. But she was great. I don't know what else she's been in, but this is definitely kind of a star make.
This is her first thing.
Really?
They really needed to find a very specific type of person for this role, right? Which is like a convincing bodybuilder with charisma.
She's fantastic and very watchable and convincing bodybuilder. And, her journey in a lot of ways was much more interesting than Kristen Stewart's, whose story was I felt like I'd seen it before. And, and Ed Harris is a pro. And he's fine, but I think that the Katie O'Brien is the big takeaway from this movie.
She's the big takeaway. She's the most dimensional character, which I think is maybe another reason I had a problem with this movie, is that the other characters are so boring. Ed Harris's villain was boring. Jenna Malone as the abused sister is boring. Anna Baryshnikov as the, like, the thirsty lesbian, maybe sometimes lover or not, of Kristen Stewart.
She was kind of fun.
She's kind of fun, but it's also kind of like, and Dave Franco is just.
I would have liked to have seen it more centered on Katie O'Brien's character too. Like, she drifts into town, she finds, from her point of view rather than Kristen Stewart's point of view. So there's some sort of, she's the real noir tragedy in some ways. She's like the femme fatale, but she ends up being, I don't know, there's just a few, there's some script problems, but whatever. I mean, I was not offended by it, and which maybe is part of the problem. You pointed out that this is like, an artifact of the new queer cinema, except that it's 2024.
Right, exactly. It's about 30 years too late.
Not very provocative. Speaking of being 30 years too late, then there we got Drive Away Dolls from Ethan Coen, which... Look, I mean, I laughed out loud a number of times during this film. Yeah, I mean, it is a funny, fun, wacky, Coen Brothers light movie. And Margaret Qualley is in it, and she's always great. And I don't remember the name of the Indian co-protagonist. Oh,
Geraldine.
Vishwanathan. Yeah, but she's Australian. Although has an American accent in this, and I thought she was great.
She's great.
The big move. There's a lot of big movie stars in it, but they're not really in it much. But they, there's a little bit of Matt Damon, a little bit of Pedro Pascal, a little bit of Coleman Domingo,
little Miley Cyrus, uncredited.
Yeah. was she one of the horny cheerleaders or the horny basketball players, volleyball players? What were they?
She was Tiffany Plastercaster.
Oh, she was Tiffany Plastercaster.
I don't want to give away.
Ironically, I knew Cynthia Plastercaster, who Tiffany Plastercaster
was. Oh, really?
Yeah, she was a Chicago character. Back when I lived in Chicago, she was the sort of artist who made the plaster casts of, like, rock stars' penises, basically, and so.
Right, exactly.
There's a character like
this. Well, look, I think I had two beefs with this. The first is that this movie reminds me of all the things that I don't like about Coen Brothers movies, where their dopey humor gets a little too dopey, and now we know which Coen brother to blame for that.
Yeah,
at least I do.
Ethan.
yeah, he's the dopey one, you know.
And right, then, and Joel is the one is who
the
gives
pretentious one.
Joel is the pretentious one, as we saw in his Macbeth, who gives the movies some structure. So, but the two together make magic.
Right, right. But but exactly, they're the peanut butter and chocolate, right? They leaven yeah. each other, they sharpen each other, and they, together they make great stuff. Separately, maybe not so much. This is pretty, you know, kind of, I don't want to say off-brand, but low-shelf Coen Brothers. And it feels like it's kind of spinning its wheels and doing what it's done before. He likes this kind of movie, but it just feels, I don't know. There was part of it that was just kind of like, I don't want to say that like hetero men can't make lesbian movies, but maybe kind of hetero men really shouldn't be making lesbian movies. Because especially guys who were in their 60s or 70s. No, he's probably 60s, right, at this point?
Yeah, yeah. Well, at least Rose Glass, I'm assuming Rose Glass is gay. I mean,
if not, then she's very queer-friendly.
If she's very queer-friendly, whereas this was like a cartoon. This was like a lesbian cartoon. And then there's a structural problem, real, as opposed to the sort of subtle structural problem I discussed with Love, Lies, Bleeding. There's a real structural problem with this, which is that the plot, first of all, it's only 84 minutes long. It's like a Tim Robinson sketch almost. the plot doesn't start until 50 minutes in, really.
Yeah.
You know, you don't really find out what the hell's going on. And so then it all kind of like gets jammed together. And it's just, you know, and then the girls on the road trip don't really know even what they're doing. They don't even know they're being chased, you know, until almost toward the end.
Right.
And so even though I found their relationship kind of sweet and a little sexy and charming, the movie refuses to commit to its story, really. You have this crime movie going on, and there's also a gay road trip comedy going on, and the two don't meet until very late.
Yeah, but you're right. I mean, there's that sweetness of the road trip, the gay road trip comedy is really it's really satisfying in a weird way. Margaret Qualley's character is fantastic as this kind of go for it and roll with it sort of, you know, Southern lesbian. I've always found her to be great, even when she's not in a good movie. She's just always the best thing of whatever she's in.
Yeah, she is. She is great. She's like, she's Andy McDowell's daughter. And I would say she's a 2.0. She's definitely, you know, she's such a good actor, you know, and Geraldine Viswamathan is, you know, makes, this is sort of her big, debut, although it didn't really do much business, and she's also got a lot of she's magnetic and charm.
Well, she was in Blockers, right? Isn't she in that comedy 4 years ago about the virgin
Blockers.
Teenagers?
Okay, she was sure she was in Blockers.
She's
okay,
been in stuff. Yeah, she's in a bunch of stuff. She's great.
Anyway, whatever. Look, but the takeaway is neither of these are bad movies. But you know, the takeaway is that maybe this is going to be a two movie trend, right? I don't think we are due for a huge explosion of lesbian noir cinema here.
No, I don't think we are, and maybe that's a good thing. Maybe that's a good thing.
Maybe, but there's no reason not to watch these movies as a double feature. They're like they are the essence of a double feature.
That's right. That's true.
It's a little grindhouse, little grindhouse flashback.
You're very fair in saying that neither of these movies are complete turkeys. They're both very entertaining in their own way. They're worth seeing. The performances are really good. The stories are a little uneven and maybe either a little too self-satisfied or a little too behind the times, but you know.
And I wonder, but I wonder what would two queer critics think of these movies? Because we're annoying. But we're not queer.
Hey, representation's important, you know? And so I think that, I mean, that's kind of what I felt about Love, Lies, Bleeding. I was like, great. Okay, now you have your, I don't know, kind of totally boring and non-provocative, stylish provocation, you know? And I don't know who Driveway Dolls is representing. I kind of cringed. It's very much like a dad movie, you know? It's like, oh, dad, what are you doing? Don't make this. You're out of touch. Oh, that's very sweet. That romance between the two of them is so sweet.
Yeah, it is sweet. And again, you know, there are some moments like, you know, when you know, who's gonna save poor Curly?
Right. I forgot about that.
There's just little bits. There's little bits where you're like, oh my god, I miss Raising Arizona.
Yeah.
You know, I watched Raising Arizona within the last couple of years, and like this made me think like, oh yeah, these are like the leftover notes from a lesbian version of Raising Arizona, basically. So anyway, all right. Well, Love, Lies, Bleeding and Driveaway Dolls are, I guess they're still in theaters. I imagine they're going to be on streaming or video on demand before I don't know, before you were done, before this conversation ends.
That's true. They will be available if they're not already, for sure. And it is a great double feature. Also because one of them is only 85 minutes long, so you're not going to...
Right, right. That's literally like a cartoon. And it is a cartoon. So there you go. All right, Stephen Garrett, thank you so much.
Of course.
All right, thank you, Stephen Garrett. We will talk to you next week about two non-lesbian movies. There may be lesbians in the movies, but they won't be explicitly lesbian movies. Also thanks to Sharon Vane and to Michael Washburn for discussing problems involving anti-Semitism, anti-Israel, and just anti-Jewishness in general in the literary community. There have been some bannings of readings and some condemnations of writers who have spoken out in favor of Israel and who are proud of their Jewishness, unlike certain creatives. And we stand against that at Book and Film Globe. I have no qualms in saying that, and I will continue to press this on the show and on the website, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We cover the world of books and film and streaming TV and so much more. I'm Neil Pollack. I'm your host. I am happy to be here every week to talk to you about things that are important and not important and everywhere between, and I will talk to you soon.
Original production.